Today is January 28th, 2019, and my name is Deborah Schwartz, and I'm sitting here in the Mill Valley Library on behalf of the Mill Valley Public Library and the Mill Valley Historical Society, and I'm in the sound booth with famed, oh my goodness, Otis Guy. I'm just going to start listing off the things that in your intro. You're a longtime Marin County firefighter, paramedic. You're a teacher. You started the mountain bike. You ran a mountain bike camp for kids.
I have for the last 10 years.
For the last 10 years. You are one of the early founders of mountain biking.
Correct. Well, Joe and I started riding mountain bikes in October of 1973 with Mark Vendetti.
So you're what I call a biker bird, natural mountain phenomenon, because anybody that lives here in Mill Valley and Marin County and on Mount Tam, or almost anywhere, really, right, we're going to see mountain bikers.
Right, but we were all roadies before.
You were roadies,
yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm really excited to have you here.
Well, thank you.
I've interviewed several other mountain bikers, founding influences, and...
Though I don't consider myself a mountain biker. I'm more where our roots are from the road, and I'm also a mountain biker on top of that, but my roots are on the road bike.
Oh. Joe, same. Right?
Joe with the same.
Yeah,
same
and
with Mark
Gary
Vendetti.
Fisher.
And same
Mark.
With Gary.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, I'm so pleased to have you here. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to share your story, your personal story about your time here in Marin County and in the world that you've inhabited for all these many years. So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just jump on in, shall we? Why don't we begin with just a little information about your family and how you came to live here in Marin County?
Well, my father was born in Boise, Idaho, but they had connections out here. My uncle had a supermarket called the Food Mart in San Rafael, and my other uncle had the bottle shop in Sausalito.
So let's say names when we talk about
names. Uncle Kurt had the bottle shop, and Uncle Maury had the Food Mart. And so my father was the youngest of four brothers, and unfortunately, all my grandparents died before I was born, so I actually don't even know their names because I never met them.
Mm-hmm.
One side of the family, my mom Marie Louise or Marlene, met my father at the end of World War II, and he brought her over from Germany to America, and that's, you know, I'm the from the union of those two, and her father was a wealthy coal industrialist in Germany, and he was actually the youngest man to win the Iron Cross in World War I. He blew up a bridge in France. And unfortunately, they were killed during the war. So I think they had already – my mom never talks about pre-World War II times. So the only time she ever spoke about it was like I got like 20 minutes when we were coming back from my father's funeral. So as far as my daughter probably has a little bit more knowledge on my history than I do, because my daughter, who's Alexis, who's 35, and I have two grandchildren, Ellis, who's the youngest one, who's almost two, and then Coretta, who's 4.5. And they're now up in Reno. But so she's spent more time talking to my mom, or as she would say, Omi, about the past. But they had, both her parents had died before her sister was killed. She was on the phone with her sister, and they were in a small suburb of Berlin. Her father, like I said, father was very wealthy. They had a pool. They had servants. She was chauffeured to school. And she was on the phone with her sister, and the Americans came over, and because he was a wealthy person, they dropped a bomb, and that's, you know, so that
disconnected
was
on the phone conversation?
Disconnected on the phone and killed all the maids and everybody else.
Oh,
and
my,
so she
that
ended
is
up,
dramatic.
That was very, I spoke with one of my mother's relatives, Aunt Margaret, who was like, there had two sisters and two brothers that each married the other ones. And so she's not really an aunt, but somehow like multiple tendrils in there to make her relative. And she would just talk about how my mom was very lost. So she was born in 1922. So she was, you know, 20-year-old person when that happened.
Utterly orphaned at that time.
Utterly orphaned. And so she ended up actually working for Werner Erhard, you know, as a secretary later in the war, And then my father later met her and brought her over to America. So she actually, my father's joke was always that she, you know, my mom never knew how to, my father's name was Robert, never knew how to boil water. She learned how to boil water in Kansas. And if you knew my mother, even on when she was on hospice and her deathbed, my daughter and I went and visited her when she was up in Oregon at an assisted living facility. And Alexis goes, "Omi, your nails and your makeup look better than mine do." So she never wore pants in her life. And so here this person who grew up very wealthy is now, you know, with married to an Air Force, you know, what was my dad probably that time, captain or something, and here now in Kansas, you know, and speaking, you know, she spoke English, of course, but my mom never lost her accent, ever. You know, so my friends would call up and they could almost never understand my mom. And my actual name is not Otis. My name is Robert Marcus Guy Jr. So my father's name was Robert Marcus Guy. And I picked up the nickname Otis when I was in high school. I played in the Santa Fe High School Band. And we did some concerts in the city and I won an award. I played the baritone horn. And for, I guess, doing a decent job than that, who knows what. And there's a music camp called the University of Pacific Music Camp, and it was a two-week camp, and it was I got to play under Arthur Fiedler from the Boston Pops. So I was recruited and got a scholarship to go up there because they needed somebody to play baritone horn. So I show up at the end of my freshman year not knowing anybody, and somebody asked my name, and I blurted out, "Otis Plum." So I was that Otis Plum for the 2 weeks there. And then I told my friends when I came back, you know, we started school again in September, and they're like, "You're Otis from now on." So that's where the nickname Otis came from.
Where did the name come from?
I don't know.
Otis Plum. I mean, the Plum part, too.
Who knows? Just popped in my head. Yeah, I mean, you're asking somebody who's like 14 years old to actually have decent reasons for things? That's never going to happen. I don't know.
Well, you might have had Otis Redding or somebody.
Who knows? I think it had more to do with, like, I didn't know anybody, and I could take on whatever identity I wanted to.
That's so interesting. Well, I'm going to continue to call you Otis.
Well, of course. Okay. That's only may have been known forever.
And so you were born in Boise.
Mm-mm.
No.
My parents already had a house in Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm.
And that my dad had one last transfer. He said, if you do one more transfer, you can stay at Hamilton Air Force Base.
Mm.
So they were there for 6 months in Montgomery, Alabama, at Maxwell Air Force Base, and I was born there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're there for 6 weeks, and then, boom, I was in Santa Fe. So what the bad part about that is that also kept me from ever being a native son.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though I lived my whole life in California, but because I was born someplace else, and so I tried to become a Native son, and one guy would not let that happen that was the head of Native Son of Golden West, and he finally died, and now, because you had other people like Bobby from S&N Auto, he was born in Nevada because the hospital where they lived was in Nevada, not in California. So he couldn't be a Native son also. So this man died. And because I was in here my whole life, I now became a Native son. So I'm now a Native. I'm the first Native son of the Golden West who was not born in California.
I don't know about the Native son.
Well, the Native sons are, you should know, they're very good on history.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So
there's a chapter in Fairfax.
Uh-huh. Ah. So now you're a Native son.
Now I'm a Native son.
You're a California boy.
I'm a very much of a California boy. I'm sure. I mean, I don't remember Alabama. I was only there for 6 weeks, so I don't remember much about it at all.
Really? I can kind of hear a little accent.
Yeah, right.
So your mother embodied that old world.
Oh, yeah. She
ambiance.
Always looked perfect. You know, I remember they had her going for a stress test near the end of her life, and they wanted her to wear pants. And she's like, she just completely flucks them. What do I do? And my second wife then, Laurel, I think set her up with some type of loose skirt or something like that, so she could do the stress test. But she never wore pants in her life. Her hair was always, like, you know, perfect, and her makeup, like I said, like my Alexis, like, "Your nails look better than mine do, Omi, and you're gonna die in a couple of days," you know. So she was pretty amazing.
It's kind of charming.
Yes. Oh yeah, it's very charming.
Yes. Well, you're, you know, in a zombie apocalypse, I'm gonna want to stay near someone like you. You're real tall, strong guy. What did you say? You were 6'7"?
I was 6'6". I think I've shrunk to
6'5". Yes, right. So you're perfect posture, well-built, all, and that's what your mother contributed to the environment, right? All these sons like you?
Well, my father was 6'4" and a half, mm-hmm. and so I look exactly like my father. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like, you know, for, you know, my third wife, Leslie, it's very funny. She's, you know, she got to meet my mom before she died, and she saw pictures of my father. It's like, God, you look exactly like him. And so it's very, very interesting.
I've already counted three wives now.
Three wives, yes.
Are we going to continue with
No, I'm done.
Okay.
Stick a fork in me, I'm done.
Okay, so tell me about you growing up in San Rafael.
San Rafael,
Yeah, tell me, well, you were born what year?
1953, October 14th, me and Dwight Eisenhower.
Okay, so tell me about San Rafael in the 50s.
It was great. So for me, this is kind of where cycling comes in. So I got my first bicycle for my fifth birthday. It came from Herb's Bike Shop in San Rafael on 4th Street. And I remember, you know, they had a house in San Rafael kind of near between San Rafael High School and the Dominican on 15 Broadview Drive. And I remember them setting me up in the backyard on the bike with the training wheels. I'm like, I don't want the training wheels. Take the training wheels off. And so
right away,
no training.
You are so self-possessed.
Yes, I don't know. Maybe I am, I guess. And
We shall turn this off. Cut that out. Okay.
So they put me on a bike. So my father, he retired from the military and then was teaching management at Hamilton Air Force Base. So mm-hmm. when he would get off, he must have started early, probably start at 7:30, then he'd get off like at 3:30 and he'd come home. And so every day when I was like, you know, a kindergartner, he would drive his, you know, his little 58 Volkswagen Bug, which was new then, mm-hmm. and would follow me to Coleman School, which up over a little hill and down to Coleman School, and then he'd follow me back. And I think as an adult now, it's like, how did your clutch stay together? I must have been going like deathly slow on a little 20-inch bike and everything else. And so once he felt I did okay, I was able to ride any place I wanted. So I would go see my uncle's Uncle Maury's store in at the food mart and visit the butcher there. So it was right near, what's the law? Was it not Chalet Basque? It was a little French restaurant. It's just off of 4th Street between 4th and 5th, uh-huh. Not too far from where the Smart Train is. It's now like an office building or something else. Yeah. So it's no longer the food mart.
Uh-huh.
And so I got a ride. I would ride down to downtown Santa Fe when I was 5 1/2 years old by myself.
You didn't want training wheels at all.
Nope,
so did you just... Did so you have a natural ability
just,
you
no,
just got on,
just,
or you had to
just
learn?
Took them off. I'm not going to learn with them. We're going to go without training wheels.
Okay, so you just said,
figured it out.
I'll get on that thing
and ride.
And I'll ride it when I can ride it.
And so for me, so this is where cycling became very important, because for me, cycling was a symbol of freedom. Mm-hmm. So that was something. So I got to do. So I got to be a little kid and go where I wanted to, because I had a bicycle that allowed me to do that.
And your brothers, too, were there?
I had no brother. I had one sister who was like almost 5 years younger than me.
Uh-huh. Karen. And that was really, but there was a lot of freedom growing up in the 50s. I also grew up in the 50s, and you could disappear and be gone all day long.
Right. That was fine in the neighborhoods. Yeah. And I think, you know, unfortunately, I'm not sure if my mom was like the best parent as far as, you know, I just think, you
keeping
know.
Keeping track.
Well, I just think it was. It's just, she grew up with maids. She grew up with, you know, it was a far different life for her. And I don't really think she saw her life being, you know, at home with kids necessarily. I think one time I think I got away and like a neighbor found me like way far away from the house. And she'd have to realize I was gone like 2 hours after I was gone. And they called the police. It was a whole to do. So I think somewhat I was like raised a little bit by the neighborhood,
uh-huh.
you know, so it's just different.
Yes. Being raised in Europe with great wealth,
yes.
many people didn't even spend that much right. time with their children.
Right.
They had enjoyed dinner with them formally, and then they were off. They went with the nannies, and wasn't the same kind of
thing.
Not helicopter parenting back then for you, huh?
Right. And then more came up, my middle son, Sterling, little kid, Sterling, my mom had something wrong with the house. I had to come over there to fix some plumbing issue. And it's like, you know, Sterling kind of ready to go to bed. And it's like, he's kind of crying. And I said, I've got to go get some plumbing pieces. Like, Mom, can you watch him? I'll put him on here, put him on the bed and, you know, just stay with him until he sleeps. Well, my mom doesn't put pillows around him. I come home, I hear like bang, and he like rolls off, like hits his head.
Oh.
I think and there's nothing against my mom, but I think, you know, I somehow just figured things out, you know, so just kind of that's.
You were a little feral then, huh?
I don't, hard to know, but, you know, again, I think as a kid, your memories and actually what is real are not so, I'm not sure if they all line up. So, you know, because I've heard different things, my kids, oh, you didn't do this or you were terrible. That I'm always like looking at him, it's like, you know, let's walk a mile in your shoes when you have kids. Let me just, let's hear about how that all works out.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
So anyway, so it's a back and forth, you know, what I think, you know, is this happened? Who knows if that actually did happen?
The house itself that you grew up in.
Yes.
Did you? I thought you were giving me the address of the
15 Broadview Drive.
Okay. 15
and so, my dad put a big room addition for me. You know, when I got bigger when my sister was born, so he was a woodworker. So he did lots of, I've had some of his furniture at my house now that he made. So he would use the wood shop at Hamilton Air Force Base, you know, in the evenings and make wood stuff. And then he started doing some remodels on the side, you know, to make some money. And I actually helped him do a couple remodels. So unfortunately for my father, was in the military when he was at the end of World War II. He was accidentally poisoned. By food, and it destroyed his spleen. His spleen was removed. And so, unfortunately, and probably both my father and I probably have the same thing, like we're going to kind of do everything ourselves, and you know, I might be a little bit stubborn, and so was he. So he peaked towards his life to try and give my mother everything, you know, she could have. So he was retired from the military, retired from civil service. They bought a bigger Mercedes and they were going to go traveling. And so he found a house in Fair Hills in Santa Fe, which is a more exclusive neighborhood, a bigger house with a pool. You know, my mom always wanted to go swimming. The house we had in Broadview Drive had none of that. And so he decided to do the termite work on the Broadview Drive house to save money. So he's spraying these horrible chemicals. It went into his liver, went systemic, and he died like 3 months later. So my father died right. They had a thing where you have like a little CA plus or CA minus for like cardiac arrest, like you're going to bring somebody back or not. How the military and the civil service worked was if my father didn't live to 60, the retirement my mom would get for benefits from my father passing away would probably be half as much. So he went into a coma about a week before he died. And he just hung in and he made it to like, it's like he knew, he made it to 60 and died like 3 hours later. So here was this thing. So they had set their whole life up for retirement, for, you know, the bigger house and all this stuff done. You know, so my mom, if you knew my mom never remarried, you know, was just like, that was it. And so it was just very, as for our life thing, it's like, you know, live life each day. You don't know when it's going to go away.
And you were how old?
Oh, let's see. So that was 1978. So I was 24 years old.
Sorry for your loss.
Oh, yeah.
That's a hard one.
Yeah, it was a big deal. You could ask my sons, when I turned 60, it was like, you know, I got to get by 60. And my son was like, you're going to live a lot longer than 60. It's like, listen, 60 is a big deal for me. I got to get by 60. My dad didn't make it past 60, so mm-hmm. I got to get past 60. Right, you know, it's like,
because
Sterling was like, what are you talking about, dude? It's like, you're fine.
So did you stay in the big house?
I've never spent a night there, actually. So I left home when I was like 17 years old. And I lived in my truck. As I said before, my father, he was a light colonel in the Air Force. You know, this is during the Vietnam War mm-hmm. and everything else. And I had already decided when I was like 13 years old and when I went to Sarfall High School, I loaded up on all the classes I could. Because in those days, your draft board got your name from your high school when you graduated.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually graduated early. I did not go to my high school graduation. And mine was the first year they had the lottery. you know, and you could not have college deferments.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no college deferment. I just had a bad feeling. So I think I pulled number 13 or number 14. And that year, you know, they went to like, I think 140. And so a lot of people went to Vietnam for that. So as you can imagine, if I'm not like, you know, grew my hair long during high school, everything else, you can imagine like my father and I did not get along so well as far as that. So as soon as I could get out of the house, I got out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and this is more brings Joe Breeze and the mountain bike thing into it. So here, so now they, you know, I don't register for the draft. You know, so which is a 5 year, you know, prison sentence and whatever the time was, like $5,000 fine, who the hell knows. And so there's a very nice attorney, Mr. Shapiro, and a longtime attorney just passed away. I think he was like 100 years old or something. And so I went and visited him to see my options. He said, well, you can be a conscientious objector. I'm like, well, if somebody like invades San Anselmo, I'm fighting. You know, so I can't be a CO because that's I would fight. And he says, well, you can go to Canada. Well, I don't want to move to Canada. You know, I want to stay here. He says, well, just stay low. You know, don't, you know, just don't make a big deal of things and everything else. Don't tell anybody and we'll just see what happens. So when I got hired by the fire department, so nothing happened. I got hired
by 13.
This is by the time I interviewed with him when I was 17 years old. Once I saw my numbers 14, I was hoping I'd get like 320.
Uh-huh.
You know, and they were. I was. You know, then I'd register. I'd be good. But 14, I'm going.
No, right.
And so that's when I met with Mr. Shapiro, and so I just kind of stayed low. When I got hired at the fire department, they had like this big, huge, like monogram, you know, with cool colors, loyalty oath to the United States that you had to sign to become a firefighter. And I'm like, oh, crap, this is where rubber meets the road. You know, so this, if I'm going to get found out, I'm getting found out right now. I signed it, nothing happened. And then Carter pardoned all the draft, you know, and what year was Carter president, 78?
Yes, after that, on the edge.
I was pardoned and all was all good.
Yes.
But now as an adult, you know, there are certainly people that died, you know, that were my age that went over, and more though I completely disagreed with the war and everything else, now as more looking back as an adult, was that the right decision? I don't know. It's the decision I made.
So, but did you have to do, now 17 years old and you're joining the fire force?
No, I started in 19, when I was 21 years old.
21.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So, and how, tell me about that. Tell me about your career, how you came upon that. First of all, your high school that you went to?
So Centerville High School. Centerville. So I went to Coleman School for elementary, then Davison Junior High School,
mm-hmm.
and then Centerville High School.
Okay.
So in those years we had like, you know, I think I was probably one of the edge of the baby boomers. So we had like, you know, 2,000 kids. I think my high school graduating class was like 450 kids.
Yeah.
So I was the class of 71, though I had taken enough classes, I didn't even have to go to my senior year. I could have graduated as a junior, but I was like, I kind of wanted to be a senior, like for at least like the first semester. So I just had a couple classes banned and a couple other classes. And then I went early, and then I didn't show up to graduation. So my name never got sent to the Selective Service. So like for Breeze, who's like the same age as I am, but he's like, I was born in October, so I was the youngest in my class. He was born in December, so he was the oldest in his class. So he was class of 72 here at TAM High School.
Mm-hmm.
So going through all this stuff, I get hired at the fire department and everything else. And this is have you interviewed Joe Breeze yet?
Yes, I have.
Yes, okay. So if you know Joe, so here I'm like plotting all these things out, worry about signing a loyalty oath, worrying all this stuff. And Carter pardons everybody. I bring up to Joe, I'm like, oh, tell him the story. He's like, Joe goes, you're supposed to register? Joe never registered, never knew he had to register, never thought one thing about it, nothing. Just got a babe in the woods, all was good, and he had no idea. It's like I wanted to wring his neck. It's like, so I'm worried all these other things, and Joe's like, register? You're supposed to register? So that's a very Joe story. But so how I got into the fire department was, I was in Scouts. I started going to the Cub Scouts at Tamarancho when I was a little kid. I can remember riding the trail that goes to where my house is. So I built a house and just 39 years ago up in Fairfax. And so at the top of Ridge Road, and so there's a trail that goes right directly to Tamarancho. I remember riding that little trail when I was like 9 years old in the Cub Scouts. And so I was a Cub Scout and then a Boy Scout and became an Eagle Scout. And so I had a very big, you know, connection with Tamarancho also. So I had some form of public service. So we we already established I was very into bicycles, graduated early, worked at the Hickory Pit as a dishwasher, started, you know, working in bike shops, riding bikes and everything else, and started working a bike shop called Mom's Apple Bikes in Sausalito, which later on became Tony Tom's Bike, you know, Bike Odyssey. It was called, you know, the name came Bike Odyssey because Mom's Apple Bikes was on 2001 Bridgeway. You know, so after the movie came, that's why, you know, Tony
right.
then, you know,
named it the 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah, so the 2001 Bike Odyssey. Mm-hmm. So it was actually run by this man, and he made me like a 5% partner, I think, just to keep me working there. And then when he decided to sell, he wanted to sell the business to me. And so I had a, in fact, I think that might have been Joe's only paid job that Joe may have ever worked. So he worked for me for a while, you know, at Mom's Apple Bikes. And as
but
much
you
as,
didn't, you know, with your 5%.
With my, whatever. I hired Joe to work when we became friends and stuff. So I think that was one of the very few, like, hourly work paid jobs he ever did in his life. Because he built frames and everything else. That's how he made his living. Mm-hmm. Nobody was giving him money. He was, you sell a frame, you get paid. So there's no hourly wages. And so I thought, should I buy the shop? So I went and saw an attorney and saw an accountant and met with them. And they were like, well, you could make a living. You wouldn't get to race your bike as much. And, you know, that's going to be kind of it. And I was like thinking, you know what? I think I want to become a firefighter. And so that's how I ended up trying to become a firefighter. So I became a volunteer in San Anselmo. I had to actually cut my hair. I went and tied my hair back to put the application in. And a guy I surfed with today, Tim Eckes, like, who I went to high school with, was two years older than me, said, you probably got to cut your hair. Mm-hmm. And so I did cut my hair, became a volunteer in San Anselmo, then later on got hired. And so that's how I became a firefighter. Because it gave you a great schedule. I liked helping people from my experience with the fire department. I used to work for a landscaping contractor, so I liked driving trucks and everything else. So it fit very well. So for me, the best part was, so when I did retire back in 2007, I invited Joe to a retirement dinner. And Joe goes, you're retiring? You're retired? He goes, you know, that fire department thing was a pretty good idea. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Not that part.
You do a good description of Joe
because if you see pictures, like I won't be in some pictures of these old mountain bike things because I was at work. Mm-hmm. I was at the firehouse. And it's like, you know, I was junior, so I'm not like getting summertime vacation to go to Crested Butte.
Mm-hmm. You missed that.
I was therefore, but I went back later on at the 86 Worlds because it's like, I'm not getting, you know, a week of vacation when I'm like a 22-year-old at the firehouse. It's mm-hmm. just not working that way. So Joe would, when Repack was going on, so my bike that I've won Repack on one time, and Joe's won like six times on my bicycle, the one that's at the museum, a 41 Schwinn. So that was the best handling of all the bikes. So Joe would come by and grab my bike at the firehouse and race on my bike mm-hmm. and win the race on my bike. And when he wasn't on my bike, when I was racing the same race, he'd be on his 37, you know, before, you know, he started building
Where
bikes.
Did you two meet?
We just met through cycling. Just, I think, probably both. I wish I could exactly remember how we met. I don't know if I was already working at Mom's Apple Bikes or we just met riding around. Mm-hmm. But the Mom's Apple Bikes I was probably working there soon afterwards. So it's just more, so I was already out of high school when I met Joe. So just fresh out of high school. And I had already, I think I, when I was working at the Hickory Pit in Mill Valley, I remember like saving up for some cycling shoes. So my first like real cycling thing I bought was cycling shoes from a Wheels Unlimited, a shop in San Rafael, a guy named Bob Hovey, who ran that for many years and had also a shop in San Francisco, who I used to later on worked and ran his shop for him for a long time.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that you were a road biker.
Yes.
First. And so you were road biking with Joe?
Yes. So we rode, that was, you know, our connection was right. We rode and raced together, raced the Mount Tam Hill Climb. We started a racing team called Velo Club Tail Pius. So there was a guy named Laurie Schmidtke that had reserved that name in case he ever wanted to start a team called Velo Club Tail Pius. And he was a guy, he was a very, very top racer, little guy, super nice guy, you know. It's very funny. It seemed a lot older. He's probably like two or three years older than we were. But like when you're like, you know, 19, somebody like being like 22 is a lot older, mm-hmm. which means like it seems like meaningless now. So I got the name from him, and we started Velo Club Tano Pius because we weren't going to be Marin Cyclists. Marin Cyclists was more of a touring group and everything else, so we wanted to start our own club.
How did you see yourself in your club? You weren't a touring club?
What were you? No, we were just racers.
You're just going fast.
Going fast. And you know, at that time, NorCal, Nevada was the top region in the country for road cycling. So, you know, you had some of the best, you know, cyclists ever come from here. You know, Bob Tetzloff. Owen Mulhone, who raced, but many others, you know, and for more modern people like Greg LeMond, you know, he came, he was a NorCal Nevada rider, mm-hmm. you know, Jacques Boyer, George Mount, Mark Pringle, you know, Tom Hardy, all these different names, all people that we raced with. So this was like, you know, Gary Fisher, this was the fertile area of cycling. This is the place. So that's, you know, so it's not just mountain biking. It was road biking also. So we had phenomenal road races. You know, criteriums weren't just an hour. Criteriums were 100K or 50 miles. You know, so it's just,
And you organized these races?
No, we did. Velo Club Tano Pius, we put on the Tour of Marin. So we'd have put a stage race on that. Actually, we had a road stage that went around Paradise Drive, like five laps. Then we had a time trial that went from near the cheese factory to near San Marin High School. Mm-hmm. And then we had a road race that did all of Tamales, you know, all the way back. So we did all those things when we were like very young, like 1976, 1970, you know, 75 in those years we were putting on the Tour of Marin, because at that time, if you had a cycling team that was registered with, at that time, well, it's probably the American Bicycle League of America, your requirement to have a team was to put one race on a year.
I see.
Which allows people to have races if nobody's going to put
it. And you publicize them?
No, publicize. It was a big deal, yeah.
What kind of equipment did you wear? I mean, did people wear helmets back then?
No. Never wore. Only time we wore helmets was in races, and those were like the, you know, the strapped, you know, helmets. Uh-huh. So basically all it would probably do was like put all the forces in one part and like crack your skull right there.
And you're a fireman. You're going to be going in. Your career has progressed.
Right.
Your passion has progressed as you're in rescue.
Right.
You're trained as a paramedic, correct?
Right. Well, later on, yes.
Yes. So
I was the
you're
first
well
EMT.
Aware.
Yeah. But I'm not never going to hit my head. I've never hit my head yet, so I'm not so concerned.
I'm knocking on wood. Your wooden hair.
Yes, right here. No, but later on, I didn't. So we just wore strap helmets. I didn't start wearing helmets till my second wife, Laurel, when she was doing her internship at Kentfield Rehab to become a physical therapist in like 1991 or in that zone somewhere, 92.
That'll 91. Leave an impression.
And she's like, I don't want to take care of a vegetable. You have to start wearing a helmet on your regular rides. And by those years, you actually had, you know, functioning helmets that were, you know, decent Bell helmets or whatever, Giro helmets that weren't big monstrous things that were actually light and somewhat breathe. So, but yeah, we never wore helmets.
When you think about some of the people that still live in this community, I've interviewed Gary Fisher,
mm-hmm,
who was
sure.
quite a good racer, and
oh,
Joe,
yeah.
Do you have any particular memories of experience with them or their abilities as riders?
Oh, yes. Well, Gary was the one that, you know, when we, you know, met Gary and stuff, he really helped us a lot as far as for Breeze, myself, Mark Vendetti. Because Gary's probably 3 years older than I am. I think Gary might be 68 now. In that zone, I think about 3 years older. And so he started racing when he was like, you know, 12 years old or something.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, you know, big time junior and everything else. So when we started getting our group rides together, you know, in those days, you know, when somebody would ride through with cycling shorts, you knew who they were. I mean, it wasn't like there's thousands of cyclists. Anybody that was riding and had real cycling clothing on, you were either knew them or you're about to know them, you know, because there weren't that many of us. It's a small sport.
Did you find that you were kind of hidden in plain sight, that there were a lot of people living here that weren't aware of how organized the racing was, or was it quite apparent?
No, it was not apparent.
No,
but if it's like anything else. I mean, there could be paddleboard races that are happening all the time that I don't know about.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, that's not necessarily unique,
uh-huh.
you know, but I mean, yeah, for the fire department, I never said a word about the cycling thing.
So you lived two lives.
Well, it's just whatever. You got, you know, remember those days at the fire department, you're working with people that are, you know, a lot older than you, and they're like older than your dad, and they can like barely move. You know, I started before 911. There was no 911. I started before electricity. There were no AEDs, you know, so there were, we didn't use gloves. The gloves didn't happen until the AIDS crisis.
Right.
So was, but so you're working with these old guys, and, you know, we staffed the radios at night. We had a secretary that staffed the radio during the daytime and at night, so you'd have to be houseman. So somebody would have to take the turn not to get to go to the fire and have to stay back and, you know, staff the radios. Well, the old guys usually didn't want to fight the fire, so they'd like stay back, which is like nice. So you got to do all this stuff. So, yeah, there's, it's just all different. It's,
let's divert just a little bit away from the biking. We'll go back to that,
right.
But get back to the firefighting.
Yes.
You said you were the first EMT?
I took the first EMT class in Marin.
At College of Marin?
At College of Marin with Pat Williams, who you interviewed, Tim Ecke, Brian McCarthy. Who else did that, you know, from our department did it at the same time? It might have just been us. So three or four. So that was the first time they offered EMT, emergency medical technician.
I took an EMT class at College of Marin.
Right.
It was excellent. Mm-hmm. And so you took the EMT class, the first, but then you went on to paramedic?
So later on, so they, you know, when we got paramedics in the 80s, you know, they actually brought us to the Civic Center to interview us. If that was, they said this was your only chance to be a paramedic was to come to this interview. And they still hadn't figured out what they were going to do. And they later on just hired county you know, firefighters to staff the ambulances. Mm-hmm. So it's like more I'm going for this interview. And basically, well, I'm kind of interviewing you. So it's like, what's the plan? You know, I'm not sure what I'm interviewing for because I don't even really have a job yet. And how are you setting it up? So I probably didn't do a very good job in the interview. But they chose to go with the county. But later on, for Ross Valley Fire, we couldn't. There wasn't enough calls to staff three ambulances in the Ross Valley. Because later on, Corte Madera had their own ambulance as part of the Ross Valley Paramedic Authority. So they realized for the Sleepy Hollow station, Station 20, and the Station 21, the Fairfax station, that they needed to have paramedics on engines. Mm-hmm. So when that happened, I was sent to, you had to take a test in City College, had a paramedic program. Mm-hmm. So three of us took that test, and only two of us passed, a guy named Craig Dow and I. And so Craig Dow, kind of not really a cyclist, well, the City College campus, the Hay Street campus, which is basically just across the bridge, right next to Haight-Ashbury. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm like, Dow, guess what you're doing? What, we're going to be riding in on a tandem, you know, and you're taking a sunshine, you're getting some cycling clothes, some, you know, cycling shoes, and you're hopping on the tandem because we'd go 2 days a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, for like 8 or 9 hours. So we rode in for a year on this tandem, you know, into the city, and it was great. You know, we had a great time, but it's more like, this is the deal, man. I'm getting a bike ride in. If I'm going to paramedic school all day, I'm getting a bike ride in on the way there and the way back. Ah. I'm all good.
You know, so Pat Williams was, yes, and he is, when I interviewed him the other day, I just want to note this in this interview, is that he's the innkeeper at the West Point Inn.
For quite a long time.
For quite a long time, and spent a lot of time in the lookout station at the top of Mount
Way back
Tamalpais.
When, before he became a firefighter.
Yes, right. So in our pre-interview chat, it became apparent that we have known each other in the past when I was a volunteer fire person and at your station in Ross.
In
San Anselmo. San Anselmo, right. Actually, I've kind of visited various stations. And I remember quite well the camaraderie that was there. Mm-hmm. Being a woman, and I'm a small woman, it was pretty intimidating.
Everybody was I think we're all very nice, though.
You were very nice.
Because we always, our department always set a really good culture.
Yes.
And the culture is you get on each other with love, not with trying to get over.
Yes.
You know, so you give each other a hard time to bring out your best and bring you in, not to give somebody a hard time to push you away.
Yes.
So it would be always funny now to go to different retirement dinners with somebody who was like a volunteer for us and later on got to Mill Valley. And you go to the dinner and they like do nothing but talk about like, I worked with Tim or I worked with Otis or this different people, they had like this whole memory that it was very interesting. So it was a very special department. So it was really set up well.
You were all gentlemen. I was 23 years old and long blonde hair, and I was only ever treated in the most gentlemanly fashion with you guys. No funny business, which I very much appreciated. For someone like me at that time, I realized I would never be able to pull someone like you out of a danger zone. I'm simply too small at 100 pounds. Mm-hmm. And that isn't fair to be that person taking up space and not be able to carry my own weight, so to speak, or yours.
Right.
But
I'm not that heavy.
I'm only
like 185 pounds. I'm not big and fat. I'm hanging in.
I do recall one time trying to take the helmet off after we'd taken a ride around on the truck, and my hair was caught, and there were three firemen there trying to untangle my hair from the helmet.
Right, with the goofy straps.
Yes, right. That was pretty sweet.
Yeah.
But I remember the culture of the firehouses. The quality of food being an important component.
Oh, no, the fire department's the only time you're hungry. If you're at the firehouse, you're hungry at noon and you're hungry at 6. And in regular life, I'm not like, oh, my God, I have to eat dinner at 6 o'clock. So we're like Pavlov's dogs.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's why I say you'd be hungry at noon, hungry at 6. But at home, I might not have lunch till 2 o'clock or not have dinner till 8 o'clock. Yeah, it's very...
There was a regimen. Things were quite organized.
Yeah.
The hierarchy of decision making and execution of decisions was quite clear, and I remember the fire chief saying, "Your life depends on these exercises and acting without thinking. It can be that way."
Right.
And I also remember that there was the captain at the time was a kind of an obsessive compulsive guy.
Yeah, Rick Molenkopf.
To the extreme, I would say.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, he would run around the track at Drake High School. And we later on found that he counted every stride for 10 miles.
That takes a lot of mental discipline to do that.
Well, that's one way of saying it. I'm not sure if I would term it mental discipline.
I'm glad
your glass half full. That's a good sign. I would term it something else personally.
Yes, there sometimes can be a line that's crossed and then it goes into something else. But it was very fastidious, and the house itself was quite fastidious, And it was interesting to be kind of an observer from the outside that never really go in. Tell me more about your life there and your experiences, your relationship with Pat Williams, who brought you up in his interview, because he's also likes to ride bikes too.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about that time at the firehouse and what it was like for you.
It was very good. The fire department, you know, it's not a real job. You know, so if, you know, I'm a bicycle frame builder, so if I don't build the frame and sell it, I'm not getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I always call the fire department an unreality job because we don't have to produce anything, right? If we could have 1,000 fires or we could have no fires and they're still going to pay you. So if you're
and
out doing...
And feed you too.
We feed ourselves. We have to pay for that. The department doesn't pay for your food.
Okay.
And that's like, you know, I can tell you lots of good Pat Williams stories on dinners. But anyways, that's beside the point. But so, you know, so whatever we're doing, so if we're doing inspection and we get a fire, we have a medical aid call, well, how important can inspection be if we can leave it? I mean, most people don't just all of a sudden get a walk out of the job for just whatever reason. So really, everything you're doing there is about training. The inspection is not about the inspection. The inspection is about checking the building out, talking to the business owner, you know, establishing a relationship. You're doing hydrants. In some senses, yes, it's maintaining the hydrants, but it's also knowing, you know, what house is this one there? What driveway? How are you going to go up that way? If a fire is there, how are you going to fight it? All these things. So really, everything you do is training there. You know, but at the same time, it's the greatest job of all time. It's, you know, it's absolutely wonderful. You know, I couldn't imagine anything better. But yeah, Pat is very infamous. I don't know if you know that. Well, there's lots of Pat Williams stories. So I think one of my first dinners at the firehouse was at the old station in downtown San Anselmo. And so you're new. So you're like, I'm not saying a friggin' word. You know, I'm going to go off what other people are doing. And I'm seen, not heard. And so we're all sitting down for dinner. And Pat runs up. And the doorway was an old station, was very low, just above my head. And Pat's tall. Mm-hmm. Pat runs in, boom, hits the door sill, gets knocked out cold. Oh. Nobody moves a muscle. Everybody just keeps continuing eating dinner. I'm like, well, if they're not moving a muscle, I'm not moving a muscle. So after like about 5 minutes, he eventually wakes up, doesn't say anything, sits down and starts eating his dinner. So there's like 1,000 Pat Williams stories of different, you know, things that he's done and different stories that let's see. We have another one here. So
these are funny.
So we would do, go on these things called strike teams when there's a big fire. And so, you're with engines from all over the Bay Area that you wouldn't see other than you go on the strike team. So when you'd work a 24-hour shift or a 12-hour shift, and then you have the time when you're having dinner and you're just chilling out. A lot of times you're camping. You're staying out in the field and everything else. And so people start telling stories. We start telling Pat Williams stories, and one after the other after the other. And they're all like, this person can – one engine was from Pacifica, the Office of Emergency Services engine from Pacifica. And they're like, that can't be true. This is – And I'm like, no, all these stories are true. Well, a few months later, Pat's like driving down the coast in his car, and he rolls into the Pacifica station there, and asks, I don't know if he asked for directions or something like that. And on his way out, he runs into one of their cars and hits the hydrant, on the way leaving. And then they're like, the guys in the strike team. They're like, that was him. That was Pat Williams. That was the guy. And they're like, all the stories were true. So it's like, that's the guy. Oh, yeah, it's pretty good.
How about some harrowing tales? I mean, this is a very woody area around here. And windy, scary roads, right. Steep pitches. People on bikes without helmets. I mean, your job was fun, but it's also incredibly important. I mean, right. You saved lives.
Right. Well, whatever.
Did you deliver any babies?
Yes, I have delivered a baby.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah. So do you have any memories in particular of something that happened in Marin that might
Well, be I remember of interest? There was a place called the Lincoln Hotel on 4th Street, and it was like kind of a single-room occupancy place, kind of in the city, so more, not homeless people, but more...
Isn't it still there?
I don't think the Lincoln Hotel's there. I think we kept burning it down.
So there's hotels like that.
Yeah, so there's, right on 4th Street, mm-hmm. and it's the third story. We're up there fighting the fire, and I'm with a guy, Bill Rollins, who's passed away, who's my captain, and Kenny Marshall, I have a good, because Kenny Marshall was not a big fire guy, and because you're a very pretty girl, I remember they had Rick was doing, Molokov was doing a whole talk on air packs and how to take all the little valves off. It had to have been the most boring class of all time. We're watching through the windows these poor volunteers. Well, Kenny, I think, was sitting right next to you because you're
this
pretty.
This is back
Kenny,
then.
That's back then. It was this guy would never sit in any lecture to save his life. So it was a very good memory. But anyways.
I had no idea. So
we, there's the second or third time we're in this fire at Lincoln Hotel. We're up on the third story. There's 15 of us all on one line, and we're in this hallway trying to fight fire. I look below me, and I can see flames underneath through the floorboards. And so I'm Kenny and Bill were no most aggressive firefighters. But I'm more thinking, we're wearing air packs, and I'm so this was early in my career, and I was thinking, well, this fire department thing was a very good idea until now, because I think I'm going to die. Because I'm figuring any moment we're going through the floor and that's it. You're done. Mm-hmm. And so I'm breathing as fast as I can to get that darn air pack to have the bell come off. Mm-hmm. And I'm also thinking, I can't believe
because once the bell comes off, you're supposed to get out.
So I'm just I'm breathing. Mm-hmm. And because it's just because you can't tap out, I'm out, that's not going to really go.
I'm scared. See you guys.
See you later.
Good luck with that.
I'm also thinking, I can't believe Bill and Kenny aren't flipping out. And somebody's bell goes off and we're all out of there. Everybody must have had the same thought. But my main thing was this was a really good idea till right now. And it's but that's you. I made my choice. And this is the choice I live with that. If I end up going through the floor and dying, that's just the way it goes. Mm-hmm. So you make your choices and you got to live with your choices. Mm-hmm. But as soon as somebody, I can't remember whose bell went off, but it was just everybody, down the stairs. We never went back into there. Mm-hmm. I was all like, it's like, we weren't doing anything. The fire was, it was done. Mm-hmm. We're not saving anything. It's like, why are we there? You know, there's no point, mm-hmm. you know, so, and that's where, you know, for firefighters now that, you know, now everything, this is unsustainable. How this new model is. So when Pat and I first started, Pat started in like 1968 or 69, I believe. You know, our grass fires or wildland fires were more like late May and June, and probably by July they were done. Mm-hmm. You know, when I retired in 2007, I'm down in Southern California, sleeping in a field in early December, and I can see Christmas tree lights on a house. Mm-hmm. So our fires now have become year round, mm-hmm. and this is not going to work. You know, I surfed with a kid the other day at Cronkite, and he worked for Southern Marine Fire. And he remembers me from a call, I think one of my last calls in Ross, not, you know, near the end, I think. And it was a poor woman that was on her Harley that was going down Oak Manor where your trailer was, that very steep hill.
I cannot believe you remember all this stuff about me from 1979
well, I mean,
and 80.
I remember different things.
Yes.
Uh-huh. But anyways... and she ran into a parked car. And I remember, all I really remember from the call was, I use it when I teach the fire departments or different places, is I never splinted her. We put her on the gurney. I had her thing because she had bones sticking out. Her foot was completely almost, her own foot almost came off her leg. And I basically spent the whole time cutting her boot off. And she had beautiful, like, leather boots and leather, you know, whatever, pants on to get so they could have access to it when they got to the hospital. I guess that kid was on that call. I think he must have been, like, a volunteer with the county. He remembers me. I don't remember him at all. Mm-hmm. I just more remember, like, focusing on her, getting her some pain medication, and just, like, let's go. Which, we're not spending time for me to, like, cut her boot off. Let's get her to the hospital because that's what you need for a trauma, is to get somebody into surgery. Mm-hmm. I don't do surgery in the field, mm-hmm. right? You know, so that's the most important
stabilize
thing.
Stabilize and transport.
Stabilize and transport. But mm-hmm. anyway, he brought this up, and he had worked, this is in June, he had worked 27 out of 29 days. He had gone to the car fire where they lost a firefighter. He went to the next fire. I'm bad on fire names. The next fire up there in Redding. And so they had lost firefighters at both those fires, 27 out of 29 days. And he's just like, you looked, he was like an empty corn husk. And it's just,
So when you say this is not sustainable, you mean to say that the don't simply don't have the manpower,
yeah,
the staffing
to do any
this, and
this is not sustainable.
Yes.
And now the fire behaviors are just, you know, we almost, I remember one of my first strike teams up at the fires up in Casadero, we're supporting a hand tool crew down in this canyon, and they'd done a 6-dozer-wide fire break, you know, so 6-dozer blades, mm-hmm. you know, wide. And, you know, we're down there. We don't really see flames and everything else. We're, like, mopping up and doing this hand tool crew, helping them out with water and all that. It jumped six dozer-wide things, and this guy, Tiki, who is a firefighter from Kentfield, you know, was on the Kentfield OES, starts, like, screaming, like, get us the fuck out of here and everything else. I'm kind of looking, I'm like, it doesn't seem that bad to me. And I got my hand tool crew to bring our hose back. They cut their hose and just left their hose. And they just jumped in the truck and started heading back up out of the canyon. And I can remember us driving along when we were out of this canyon, and you saw trees explode in front of us without any flame impingement. And the sound of the wind. And every, you know, this is like, you know, like for your poor sister, you know, passing away in the Santa Rosa fires. It flipped cars. In other words, all the fire load, everything that it did, just added on and added on and added on and added on and just swept through. There's a, you know, the Berkeley Fire did like a little YouTube video of them going up to fight the fire, and their
yes.
staging place was at Kmart. And they get to Kmart, and Kmart's on fire. And they're like, well, this doesn't make sense. I'm like, dude, this is independent action. It's like, go find something and fight it. You know, you're not, you know, there's nobody to tell you anything because they're all busy. You know, they didn't mean you to stage it in Kmart and have it be burning down. You know, that wasn't their intention.
And for firehouses that have such protocol and practice, and there's all the rich, not the ritual, but the very delineated course of action that doesn't apply now in a fires that are
right. You know, whatever the fires down south when poor Rucker was killed from Nevada. I was in Simi Valley. I'm better on the places, but I'm terrible on what the fire names were. We went down there. We went on independent action for 72 hours. Mm-hmm. So we didn't sleep for 72 hours. Nobody gave
that
us assignments.
That means you're basically on your own.
You're on your own.
No
you're fighting
plans,
fire.
Nobody communicating.
We got food from homes. So nobody fed us. Nobody gave us anything to drink. So just a neighbor would give us some food. You know, these strike teams, we just went from fire to fire to fire to fire. I got pneumonia from that fire. You know, because we didn't sleep. We're just going. So that's kind of what's going on now. This is, like I say, climate change, all the other stuff. This is, you know, unsustainable. And it gets back to also, you know, for the Santa Rosa fire, that fire, you know, one of the firefighters I worked with, Jack Berry, his father fought that fire in 1966, mm-hmm. you know, from he came up from San Francisco. So you're rebuilding in a place that's already you've proved twice to burn through. So is that a smart thing to do? You know, so I'm not sure it is. You know, we have friends that lost their home. You know, you could see St. Helena from their house up in that one of those developments mm-hmm. up there off of, I can't think of the little goofy road.
12.
Yeah, and, you know, they're going to rebuild Kelly and Lorraine. I'm like, I'm not saying this to them. It's like, I'm not rebuilding. I wouldn't rebuild. Mm-hmm. You know, it's already been proven to go. And she barely got out of there. You know, so yes.
It's alarming to hear the reality of this change and... So will the science of firefighting have to make some adaptions?
I don't know. I don't know. You know, it comes down to money. It comes down to doing the right clearance. But it's also people are building in places they probably shouldn't build. You know, how many? I've probably driven down, and probably Pat Williams has done the same. I've probably gone on strike teams down to Malibu probably 10 times in my career. And by the time we get there, it already burnt through to the ocean. We'd be there for a day, and we'd drive back and go home. So they're rebuilding the same homes. A very top mountain biker by the name of, have you heard of Tom Ritchie?
Yes.
So Tom Ritchie, so he's actually...
I hope to interview him soon,
yes,
actually.
You know, Tom's very good. So he actually, in what's the exclusive neighborhood in Santa Barbara?
Montecito.
So he was trying to build, and if you talk to Steve Potts, him and Steve were going to build some places in Point Reyes. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the whole story and the intimacy details on what happened with them and everything else. But I know that eventually Tom got frustrated dealing with the county and did not build those homes or left. And then he got this place in Montecito. It was a house that had burnt down in one of the fires. Mm-hmm. And so they waived all building fees and everything else. So then when PG&E the last time said they're going to start shutting off power when there are high winds, Tom gives me a call, you know, because now my sprinklers weren't work and everything else. He's, if you talk to Tom, he's very, very analytical, like Breeze, but in a different way. And he's kind of going, well, what happens with this if they shut the power off and everything else? And I'm kind of the same one to say, it's like, you rebuilt a friggin' house that already is burnt down before. You know, basically, this is an intelligence test. You know, I didn't say that because it'd be pretty offensive to have somebody tell you that. But I'm helping giving him solutions. But in the end, it's like, if something sounds too good to be true, you know what it is? It's too good to be true. Why are you rebuilding there? You know, but they're doing that because they want tax base and everything else, you know, for the communities. But is this the sacrifice we're doing?
It's very, we're backing ourselves into the corners. It's daunting. Beautiful places. Mm-hmm. It can be okay. It cannot. California has a very long history of fires.
Right. But nothing like this.
But over a long time.
Right.
It's part of the California landscape. Right. But now things are different because the temperature is different.
Yes.
Let's segue away now from firefighting back to the biking.
We'll go back to Gary Fisher when you're talking about earlier.
Gary Fisher, and we didn't talk about Steve Potts, another right. wonderful man. But you, as you're getting older and you're becoming more skilled as a firefighter, now you're...
Well, I've been retired for almost 12 years.
But I mean, through the expanse of your... Okay. But your skills are your skills.
Right.
I mean, you still can do emergency medicine if you have to
right.
on the trail. Bikers fact, down,
right.
you're going to be able to do something versus nothing.
Right. Well, I've taught so far this year, since August, I've taught 180 high school coaches first aid. So I designed a NICA, a National Interscholastic Cycling Association, the high school national organization, 8-hour first aid course.
Ah.
So I established that curriculum. I spent a ton of hours last year, not last year, you know, 2017.
Teaching the new CPR now?
Well, because before, for to be a high school coach, you have lots of requirements. One mm-hmm. of them was to take the Wilderness First Aid class, mm-hmm. which is a two-day class.
Yes.
So when I was a high school coach for 7 years, I just retired. So I was with a team called Sir Francis Drake High School team.
And what was the sport?
Mountain biking.
Oh, okay.
You know, so it's the premier team in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And the team's won the last four state championships.
Congratulations.
And five. Well, I didn't do any riding. And they rode, not me. And, you know, while I was coaching, we won five out of seven state championships. So, you know, the top team. So you have all these things you have to do to become a high school coach, and to do a two-day class, you know, taking a weekend away from the family and everything else is a little daunting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never taught wilderness first aid before until I became a high school coach, and I saw I'm qualified to do it. I'm a OSHI certified instructor, which is American Safety and Health Institute. I'm also an American Heart Association certified instructor, and I'm a Title 22 California State EMS instructor
mm-hmm.
because it took me only 38 years to graduate from City College with an associate's in paramedicine.
Congratulations, bump it.
Yeah, so, just 38
That's
years.
That's your time release
yes.
education.
Yes, that's what it is. So designed this course for the high school coaches to do it. So it's just, you know, common sense and everything else. So to make that easier. So that's the skills that you learn. I mean, you know, Pat Williams would be a great, you know, EMS instructor and everything else.
Mm-hmm. So, but I have to imagine that this is helpful to have somebody like you on the rides, because people get hurt all the time.
Well, now, because I go on big group road rides and big group adventure rides, not gravel rides. We don't have any gravel around here. And a mountain bike rides. I've now, in the last 2 years, I carry like a small little first aid kit
mm-hmm.
with me in all the rides. I always carried gloves in my under seat bag, but now I have like, you know.
Good for everybody on the mountain. Always
right.
carry gloves.
And, I'm kind of a dirt devil, which means, you know, incidents do find me. You know, so I seem to be one of those people that will attract, you know, medical emergencies at different times.
Uh-huh. Right. When you were riding, and you've got Gary Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, just give me an idea. Let's say I'm going to choose a year, okay? 1985.
Oh,
who are you riding with?
I've gone through about four or five generations of riders. So I was doing probably generation two or three in 85.
Okay.
You know, so I'm at that time, so Alexis is 2 years old. You know, so just, you know, riding, I started doing my race team in about 85. I think I started my own race team about that year, 85, 86. And just, you know, still racing on and off, but more, you know, still, you know, fire department, everything else. So just more for fun than realizing, okay, well, I've only got so much time I can be away from Alexis and taking care of her. So it's like, am I going to drive 2 hours to race 3 hours? Or am I just going to go for a four-hour ride here and just, like, you know, use the best hours?
Uh-huh.
So, and then start probably in the 80s, probably more mountain bike racing, you know, with some roads. So for us, remember, mountain biking was an off-season sport. So our
let's
season...
let's talk about mountain biking.
Yes.
Let's actually go to mountain
okay.
biking, because you were there. You were a frame maker.
Well, not till later on. So how this all works, so both Joe and I were into old bikes. You know, I'm talking old bikes. Like, I have a high wheeler, you know, an ordinary from 1882 that I worked at Wheels Unlimited in like 1972, a whole summer for free to get that bicycle. You know, it was a bike that came from England around Cape Horn, you know, up to Santa Fe. Santa Fe was a very big bike town. So Breeze and I were both into old bikes, you know, not necessarily, you know, the old cruiser bikes. And a guy named Mark Vendetti was a little bit younger than us, but had a connection with the Larkspur Canyonites. And those were guys that were riding these old Schwinns on the S Trail on Mount Tam. And so they were kind of like the first early people on the mountain bikes. But the difference was what made the difference to make this sport happen was that Gary, Joe, Mark, myself were all cyclists. In other words, we were going to start riding these bikes and then get a motorcycle. So we're going to, this is a lifelong sport. So when Mark Vendetti introduced us, hey, I rode these old bikes on, you know, the lower slopes of Mount Tam when I was in high school. You know, we were racing together. We were both all on the same race team, Velo Club Tampa Ice, with Gary Fisher and everything else. And Mark told us about these bikes and what the right bike to get pre-World War II that had a higher bottom bracket and setting pins in the back. Don't use a new departure hub. Use a Moro hub, which is these beautiful brass shoe rear, you know, foot brake hub. And so this is the bike to get. So in October of 73, we started riding those bicycles. And for us, it was an off-season diversion. So in a sense, these bicycles took us away from like collecting really old bicycles, which were what we were more interested in, bikes from the 1880s, you know, through like 1920s, you know, rather than, you know, the paperboy bikes were not that interesting, you know, relatively speaking. And, but when we started riding these bikes, they were fun. And it allowed you to, you know, what you would do for a 5-hour hike on Mount Tam, you could ride around on the cruiser bike with a 1 speed and do it in a couple hours. And for us also, if you're thinking about those days when we're racing on the road, we're racing with drop bars, mm-hmm. you know, with non-index shifting, with like silk tires, you know, they get flats and everything else. And so here you have something that was a single speed mountain bike. You were never going to have a mechanical. You were never going to get a flat. The bikes had a patina, had history to them. They were kind of cool in their own, you know, with the beautiful, spears and stuff in the paint, mm-hmm. and just the Moro hubs with these beautiful brass shoes and all these different things. So, and it was fun. You know, we got to go. So we'd have like metal pedals that we'd like, these leotard pedals that we'd like braze, because when you'd hit rocks, and those are also the years that were the drought years in Marin County. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was good weather. So it was a great off-season diversion.
What is the road season?
Road season is basically, you know, the races really get going in late March and goes till like the first week in October.
So then in October becomes mountain bike.
And
this is the clunkers. We're talking the early clunkers.
1-speed bikes that weigh like 45 pounds, like a 37 to 41 Schwinn's. So that's the bikes we started riding.
So at this time, are you hanging out now with Charlie Kelly? And
we met Charlie later on. So we, you know, Charlie was never, you know, he was a little bit of, you know, he was more came in about the mountain bike time, mm-hmm. rather than he was not a roadie. You know, Fred Wolf wasn't a roadie. Charlie wasn't a roadie. He did later on do some, you know, racing on the road.
And Steve Potts not a roadie. Not he a roadie. Was
Steve Potts
he
was
did
never.
Motorcycle.
He did motorcycle, and you know, he wasn't a roadie.
Yeah.
So the road people were, you know, and Richie was a roadie. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and Richie didn't come on till later. But so the true
later
roadie,
being
later, you know, Richie's like 2 years younger than this. He didn't start building the first, you know, mountain bikes he built were for Gary back in 19, you know, I can tell that story, you mm-hmm. know, for the 78. So when we brought, when Joe made the first modern mountain bike, we brought one of those bikes down and Tom built Joe and I a frame for us to try and break the transcontinental record in 1979. Mm-hmm. And that's the first time he saw a mountain bike. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so this is more these bikes. And so we're riding them, enjoying them. We'd bring them to the races. I mean, we were probably riding them 2 or 3 months before, you know, Gary started riding the mountain bikes. We showed Gary the bikes and then Charlie, and they were already living together in San Anselmo and stuff, mm-hmm. you know, so that's kind of more where it came from, that side.
Mm-hmm.
But we're, you know, Joe, Mark and I were more best friends. Mm-hmm. You know, and Gary, we were teammates with him. We were very good friends with him. But we weren't, I was doing on the road riding, you know, we'd be doing big rides with Gary and different people from the East Bay. But it was like Gary wasn't the one that was going on all the rides with us so much. Mm-hmm. You know, it was
so
more,
these are your cadre. These are your brothers
yeah,
in arms.
These, yes.
are your, these are your people
yes.
on the
and,
mountain.
And, yes.
Yeah. And at what point did you start getting involved yourself as far as the development and the building of?
So what kind of helped, the firehouse kind of helped with this too. So here I'm coming down with this bicycle, you know, that, so the old firemen, the firefighters, they remember these bicycles as kids and they're kind of like fun bikes. And all of a sudden the fire guys are like, oh, this is kind of a cool bike. These are fun because do most people want to ride on a skinny tire drop bar bike? So Joe and I saw these bikes not as just mountain bikes, but as bicycles as transportation. So we were in, remember, we're in for the duration.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, so we're about.
This is a lifestyle choice for
it's
you.
It's a lifestyle choice, but it's also a lifestyle choice as far as, you know, efficiency and transportation. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just going on TAM. It was also just, why can't you use these bikes to go get a quart of milk?
Yes.
You know, so
I don't think Joe had a car, actually.
I taught Joe how to drive my MGA. Yes, and Joe still drives like he's about 22 years old. So he's like...
ironic, since his father
built
race
cars. Race car driver,
yeah.
Yes. His father was a phenomenal driver and a very good cyclist, too.
But he did not want his sons to own, or his children to own cars.
Yeah, I think that was going to be a Joe and Richard thing anyways, though. Mm. You know, that was going to be, you know, Joe was not a big car guy that way.
Yeah.
I mean, he liked cars, but he wasn't going to be a driver. Like I said, I think I taught him to drive when he was 25.
Okay, so it's more than something that, it's not a sport, it's a lifestyle.
Yes.
It's how you get from point A to point B. And of course, at this time, we're talking about the birth of environmentalism, really. The you know, the gas prices were
right.
up. So there were practical reasons to think
right.
of this as a healthier alternative.
Right.
Right. Okay. So.
So we just started riding these things, and then, you know, we take him to races with us. And the difference was that, you know, Gary, you know, myself, Joe, Mark, we were all working in bike shops or part of the industry in some way. So instead of it just being some dope-smoking kids from Marin, we're actually people that were part of the industry. So when we said to somebody, hey, we need aluminum rims, what we actually had to say meant something.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd take these bikes to the races with us when we race on the road. And poor, you know, I had a 1950 GMC milk truck. That was an old Foremost milk truck with a little, you know, dots on them, the orange and white and everything else. So that was our race vehicle. So we'd drive to Oregon, Southern California. And it's always very funny with Gary on the bikes because Mark, Joe, and I, we're driving if we're coming back from a race and there's a town where this was a train town, because train towns were usually more wealthier towns, we'd be like driving two towns looking on porches to find the bikes.
Because to go scavenge.
To scavenge. Or we'd go by old dumps, and Gary would always like, I don't want to stop at any more places to look for old bikes.
You're looking for parts.
We're looking for parts and frames and everything else. Oh, yeah, that's how we got all that stuff.
This is truly the culture that you've immersed yourself in.
In a different way.
You have when you think about it, you have this, it's a hobby, but you're in it. This is, and you really don't have a lot of support in the outside world, is what's interesting to me. You guys were kind of on an individual's journey here.
Yes. That's all, it's all
this
good.
This is really, you were the vanguards in every way. Something inside you compelled you to go in this direction.
Yeah. And then for Joe started building frames in like 1975, I think. And, you know, Joe would give you or 74. He took Albert Eisentraut's, he was the premier frame builder in America at the time, was really started the frame building revolution, you know, and I'd say in America. And, you know, so Joe built himself a bike in the class. The second bike he ever built was for me. And the third bike he built was for Mark.
I have a really important question to ask you. Do you still have that bike?
No, I don't. I sold it to get another bike when Joe built me another bike.
And where is it?
I have no idea.
Oh.
I'm hoping it someday shows up.
Oh.
The only first bike I've built, I started building frames in 1982. Because I was tired of working bike shops, and I had my own ideas of how I want frames to be, and I worked with Joe for a while, helping him build frames, you know, cutting up tubing and doing all that type of stuff. So I decided I got tired of dealing with retail and bike shops, and so I started building my frames.
Where? At home?
At home. So when I built my home, I like dug out underneath the house and made a shop, and actually my truck, the truck I drove here today after surfing, is an old 55. Dodge pickup truck. It went through the flood in 1981, January 4th, 1981, in San Selmo, went over the carburetor. And so they totaled it, but then gave it to me. And they gave me like $1,500. And that's how I bought my first lathe and my first mill was from the proceeds from that. So Joe took the 2-year machine shop class at College Marin. Mm-hmm. And this phenomenal teacher, Ray Matosa, who was the program director. I had talked to him a couple times, so I talked to Mr. Matosa and asked him, hey, can I jump in the 2-year program and make all my fixtures for building frames? He's like, yes, you can. And I learned some good lessons from Mr. Matosa. So Mr. Matosa, at that time, a lot of Vietnamese were like fleeing, you know, Vietnam and coming over. And so this guy found a teacher at College Marin, or knew somebody at College Marin that also knew Vietnamese and English, and he put together, so he'd get these Vietnamese refugees, have him take his class because he could guarantee him a job in a machine shop afterwards. So they'd be in his class, and then he'd arrange for somebody to teach them English after class. And it was like this guy was Mr. Matoza. Ray Matoza was like he was one of the early machinists that did machining for George Lucas, like for the cameras to spin and everything else. That he would work for George in the summertime when the school wasn't going on. But what I learned from him also was, if you're in, he'd spend tons of time with you. But just like if when your teacher, he had some kid taking machine shop class that could give a crap about it and doing everything, he was basically like F you. Mm-hmm. Not like being angry at him, but basically...
Don't waste my time. But if you want my time, I'm yours.
I'm yours. And right. He was really, really good. And that exemplified it by what he did for the Vietnamese refugees coming in.
Mm-hmm. At what point did it occur to you that what you all were involved in is starting to really catch fire and it's starting to change the world?
Well, it wasn't just us. It was helping get that going. And, you know, the Mike Sinyard to the wall, from Specialized, who, you know, started, you know, he used to deliver parts to us in his van before he started, you know, Specialized, the large company. It got it going. In the end, like Joe and I tried to break the transcontinental record in 1976 and 1979 and try to ride across the country in 10 days on a tandem. And the reason we did that was if we can get across the country in 10 days in a tandem, you can go to the grocery store and, like, get a quart of milk and some eggs, right?
Yes.
And that was more the point. So it wasn't just for our individual glory. It was also to prove a point, what you could do with a bicycle. So just to see all that stuff grow, for me, I'm the only person to race in Repac and win Repac. I also did the first mountain bike national championships, and I did the first world championships. I'm the only person to do that. So I never stopped. You know, so, you know, I actually rode a Breezer. I'd already started building bikes and had one of my own mountain bikes. I rode my Breezer in the first mountain bike national championships because I wanted a bike that was the first modern bike to be in the first, you know, the first U.S. national mountain bike championships. And then I remember doing the first world championships, which was in Durango. And I remember racing the Masters at that point and coming across the line in tears to see how we've gone from a sport that we're just in October of 73, you know, these, you know, kind of hippie kids, you know, riding on Mount Tam, to see us now become a worldwide sport. And because that happened, made bikes better in the entire world, because you now brought America into the bike industry. And not just like getting a Schwinn, you know, Varsity, but real bikes. And so that now it made the improvements. Now you had kid bikes that basically, if they had gears, they worked like crap. And if they had brakes, they barely worked. Now you had brought Japan in, you brought Europe in. There was enough people here to buy bikes that they made more improvements. So it wasn't just mountain bikes. It was also road bikes, and all bikes got improved by bringing America in. And so it's very good to feel like you had some small contribution to help make that happen.
It does seem, when you think about the old bikes and how specialized they were, that it was constrained how you used bikes. But now...
It's game on, baby.
It can change. Well, Tom Ritchie in Rwanda.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
I mean, it can change. It has changed. It's changed lives utterly.
Yes.
But it's not using any fossil fuels.
No, and the very tough thing. So Tom, the Rwanda project's absolutely incredible. But you know, what he learned from that, so he made this really cool wood rack, you know, for the bikes, you know, to put on the bikes from the transport to the coffee beans. I remember telling me that was like one of the worst things he did, because they looked at it being wood as being shittier. You know, he thought it was the wood was like, you know, hey, this is part of your wood, you if in your... In your area in Rwanda and everything else. I mean, it's beautiful. They're beautiful like racks. And it was actually more of a negative, because they would have been happier if they were metal, because they thought that would actually be improved. They more looked at the wood being as not as good.
Well, the people listening to this interview won't understand what we're talking about. But in fact, Tom Ritchie went to Rwanda and helped you can tell the story better. It really is a life changer.
He went there just to, you know, bicycles as transportation, just like I brought earlier. This is how you can move the coffee beans from place to place with these bicycles as transport and make these put these bikes together that are basically, you know, bomb-proof bikes you can throw off a cliff that'll keep moving. And just instead of, you know, having you no way to be able to move your beans to market to be able to sell them to keep your family alive, mm-hmm. you know, that's, it's a huge, you know, Tom would be far better because I, you know.
Yes, I will know, reach out to him. Yes. Yes. But it describes perfectly the unintended consequences. How something, when you have innovation of some form, how then it radiates in all kinds of
yes.
ways and beyond perhaps even your own imagining.
Right.
And yet it can be so profound.
Mm-hmm.
So that must have felt good to know that you this, you know, you. But what's also so interesting to me, because I'm friends with Joe and Connie and Charlie and Steve, is that there's a lot of love in your
oh,
group.
Yeah.
I mean, there's camaraderie, there's friendship. It's not just fueled by innovation and interesting, you know, interested minds trying to change things so they can ride fun things. But this is friendship.
Right.
This is love. This is togetherness.
Right.
This is community.
Well, you, like I said, I would know everybody that rode through Marin with cycling shorts on. So why wouldn't we be, it's, you know, it's, what was a great quote? It was just somebody in the news. Why would there be a rivalry? So you're all in it together. All I know is it was a coach. That's right. It was a coach for a football team that came across, hey, you just, how you act and how everything else, you treat everybody the same, you treat them well. And this guy's like, you're kind of giving me credit for something that's, I'm not thinking about. You know what I mean? Because isn't that kind of how you should be? And that's the same type of thing. It's like that's isn't that, you know, what you learned in kindergarten, how you're supposed to treat people? That's so we, you know, it's not, you know, am I a better frame builder than Steve or frame? Who gives a crap? You know, it's like life is too friggin' short. So, yes, it's all, we're all kind of in it together in different ways.
And that brings us to another subject I want to talk about, and that is the biking museum.
Yes.
Let's talk about
yes, the Marin Museum of Bicycling,
mm-hmm.
and which houses the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
So there are these bikes that Joe and I saw, the Igler collection. So we're racing down a race in Redwood City or Palo Alto. There's great crits down there, Criterium races on the road bike. And we heard about this man, Mr. Igler, Ralph Igler, who had this collection of old bikes. Remember I told you early on that we were into old bikes, mm-hmm. not just these old mm-hmm. piece of crap.
That you'd
know,
worked at this place all
yeah,
summer,
summer
long
everything
just to
else.
Get
the, yes. And I have a bike from the 1890s and zeros and 10s and 20s, all this stuff. And he had this incredible collection of bikes that we saw probably in like Joe's better with dates than I am. It could have been 1974 or something like that. And we always said, to the both of us, if we ever open a museum, a bicycle museum, we got to get these bikes. And so we ended up, you know, doing this museum. And it kind of was very good because, I don't know, Mark Vendetti, you've heard me say mm-hmm. the name a few times. Mm-hmm. So our friend Mark Vendetti went away up to, he worked on crab boats up in Alaska, and then later on settled in Seattle. I was his best man at his wedding, you know, a few years later. But he was no longer around. But he ended up coming back here to Marin. And when he came back here, we got all these old friends from like 1972, and with Connie and with his wife Lena, and we decided to start the museum. And so that's. So it was more, and that was like, we got to find these bikes. And Joe did find the bikes. Poor Mr. Igler had passed away, and his son had them down south. And so one of the first things when we met to have the museum was like, I said, if we're going to have the museum, the U.S. Bicycle Hall of Fame moved to Davis a few years ago. We have to have the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame. So that was my first thing. We've got to get the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame. We talked to Don and Kay Cook, and I think they were kind of done, you know, trying to run the Hall of Fame. So we brought the Hall of Fame out here. So we flew out, you know, to Colorado, rented a U-Haul, went to Crested Butte, and loaded up all the stuff that was out there and drove all night with all the stuff, you know, from the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame. And then it took a few years. We found the space. My TIG welder lived in the museum for like 6 months. I went through like, I think, 48 sticks of TIG welding rod, you know, making all the fixtures and everything else.
To hang the bikes.
To hold the bikes mm-hmm. up and the whole thing. And it's very fun because you're back to like, you know, back in the old days when Joe's building frames and everything else. So he's kind of like, it's, you know, how do you put it? It's just like brings it all back full circle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, and, you know, Joe's, And Joe's still very amazing. So Joe would he'll stay up like 3 days doing something, 3 days in a row, you know, or whatever it is. He'll stay up all night. It's like, you know, I'm done with that. I'm not, you know, we're working till whatever it is, 9 o'clock at night. I'm not staying up till 3 in the morning to do something. I'm done with that. Not doing it. But Joe's determined. You know, he
goes down the rabbit hole.
Oh, he hits the rabbit hole hard.
Yes. I've been into a study where we were looking at some photographs that he had. Someone had brought him a book of old writing clubs.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's an incredible book.
And we were looking at the photographs, and then it was hours later.
Oh, no.
This time goes away. Oh, and his capacity to stay focused is remarkable.
Oh, yeah. He's a true believer. But at the same time, you know, and Joe, it's, you know, Joe, bless his heart. I mean, he... You know, though luckily it's almost kind of a curse. Both, you know, his father is like, everything's got to be absolutely perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe, everything's got to be actually perfect. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know about his brother, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so unfortunately for Richard, you know, his older brother, not older brother that's his, from his father and his mother, because he's Joe's got half brothers and Richard's have half brothers that are like another generation ahead of him and mm-hmm. sister. Poor Richard took that exactness to the level of where I'm assuming right now, Deborah, that I'm talking to you. So, and I'm in this room with all this stuff here, and I'm kind of going with that as a baseline. And I'm okay with that. If I'm wrong and this is all a big dream and it's not right, well, I'm okay with that too. That reality sounds okay. For Richard questioned absolutely everything in life to where is this chair here? And if you can imagine, you talk about going down a rabbit hole, where that would take you when you question the air I'm breathing and everything else. And Richard, what was that, the Kuwaiti War? You immolated himself in San Francisco
mm-hmm.
and set himself on fire and
mm-hmm.
and died.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the firefighters, Marty Marcucci, always said something. He says, be careful. You get into something too much, you get weird. You know, so you always got to be careful with that. But that's more, you know, for Joe's stuff there, you know, Joe's dad was like pretty intense. You know, I wasn't scared of him, but, you know, he's game on. You know, you had
not
to be
messing
exactly,
around.
You're not messing around. And I remember Joe lived at home his whole life. You know, that's why his only paying job was for me at Mom's Apple Bikes way back when, like for $6 an hour, God knows what it was. And I remember, so his mom had already, his father had passed away, and his mom was really much more in Tahoe, and then I think they were going to sell the house. And so
The
Country Club Drive, yes.
Yes.
Right mm-hmm. across from, what's the rocker's name? For God's sake, Steve, I'll remember this last name a little bit. You know, from Chicago, mm-hmm. a rock and roll guy who lived across the street from him,
mm-hmm.
Steve Miller.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Miller lived across the street. So Joe would sometimes get Steve Miller's leftover rock and roll clothes because they were both the same size, like with like, you know, boots with like bigger heels and stuff. It's just total, it's total crack up. Anyways, so like when anytime it rained, like Joe had these like logs of all like, you know, rainfall, temperature and everything else. So Joe goes to move out of the house and Joe calls him up. He's like, I've got all these logs of like, you know, it's like if it rained hard, he'd like wake up at 1 in the morning and write, okay, it rained like, you know, 0.3 inches, you know, from 112 to like, you know, 147. And Joe's like, I've got all these things, you know, I'm not sure what to do with them. I'm like, well, maybe you should have thought of that before you started them. You
know, what fuels greatness?
That would have been a good idea. And I said it very kindly. And I said, well, you know, donate to the library or something like that. I'm sure they, you know, like to have the different records, but that's a very good Joe story.
But it's a very good start if you're going to have a museum
yes.
with history.
Oh, no, he's the man.
Oh, he is.
Oh,
Joe's really
absolutely incredible. Forces. So it's very wonderful. So the reason to have the museum was just to be able to, first, I don't know why there's so much acrimony with mountain bikes and everything. It was cycling here in Marin County, especially where the birthplace. Why can't we ride on all the single trails?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have friends that I ride with up in Tahoe, and we're riding on single track trails that have horses, motorcyclists, hikers, and cyclists. And it all works.
It's a touchy subject around here with the hiker groups.
No, but I'm just more saying, so why is that happening? I think little by little, the bricks are coming out of that wall. And for us, the museum is another way to help bring that, take out another brick to make it so that everything's more accepted, and also to celebrate cycling and to celebrate
it
its history.
It legitimizes. Yes. And also, sometimes education is the best defense.
Mm-hmm. So the museum's very wonderful. And then when we brought the Hall of Fame out here, so now for the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame, so I've been the director now for a while of the Hall of Fame. And before, you know, my dog Barton, who's a very good dog, who's done Tamarancho, Barton could have been on the ballot of the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame. So if you, Deborah, wanted to be in the ballot of the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame, you could just put a submission in and you'd be on the ballot. So when they'd have the voting, I'd be reading. I was probably one of the few people that would read everybody's name. I'm like, you know, oh, good, you rode a bike in Kansas. Who gives a crap? You know, it's like,
if a dog's doing something I'd be interested. You know, you really ought to have dogs in the Hall.
There we go.
There's a lot of dogs.
Junior, Fred's dog, who came on tons of bike rides with us.
Yes.
You know, and then also my dog. Brandy did 50-mile mountain bike rides. Actually, in my preparation for the first national championships, you know, she did a 50-mile mountain bike ride with me from Fairfax all the way around.
Anyways. We're going to talk later because I'm working on a history talk about famous dogs in Marin County.
Go.
So we'll include the biker dogs.
So include Junior. Junior's probably the genesis.
Yes.
But, you know, just where was I at now?
You're talking about the legitimate.
The Mountain Bike Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
So once I took over, it's like, okay, you know, you've got to have actually people that, you know, matter. So I put together a thing where you had to put in a submission. And I put together a nominating committee of mountain bikers around the world. You know, so it's not just here because people would have the perceptions of the Marin County Mountain Bike Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And it's been crested.
It's been in
Crested Butte all these years, so it never was the Marin County Hall of Fame.
Yes.
But, you know, with all these different things, so now I've set it up so you have to go before the nominating committee to make it onto the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
So I must be doing a better job because the last 2 years I've not been F-bombed because it's usually, you know, if people don't make it, it's like, you know, how the fuck can you not know that I should be in the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame? It's like, it's not my job to know. It's your job to tell me and your job to convince me.
Mm-hmm. You know, and how many do you select each year?
We only induct four every year. Mm-hmm. If I got 50 people that were worthy of being in the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame, they'd be on the ballot.
And how many do you induct into the Hall of Fame?
Just four a year.
Just four a year.
Four a year right now.
Yeah. And how many have you in the Hall of Fame?
Okay, so like 182 or something like that. Shows better on numbers.
So you're retired now for almost over 10 years.
Yes, it'll be 12 years in June.
But you sound really busy.
I know. That's the problem. See, I went to the firehouse to rest, and now I have no place to rest. It really sucks. You know, so it's like, I don't have, so this is my recovery right now. So it's like.
Sitting here in this quiet room is a moment's pause.
So that's it. No, what? I like to be busy, you know, so
you've got a tremendous amount of energy just watching you.
Well, I'm a shell of my form. I feel like I've got no energy.
You know,
I'm very nice to say that, but no, I'm like, you know, but I went for a 2-hour surf today. You know, I did, that's why Marv said I've gone through a few different, you know, generations of cyclists. I still ride with fast groups. So basically, but now, you know, I'm dropping heartbeats like every friggin' day.
Okay,
my max heart rate keeps going dropping. And remember, I was, you know, Breeze, you know, Vendetti, Fisher. Fisher drips, these people drip with talent. I was good enough to be shitty. You know what I mean? So I was good enough to be there, but basically, so I was Cat 1 when there was only Cat, you know, 60 Cat 1s, but I'm basically, if the sun, moon, and stars lined up, you know, I could do something. But I'm not like Breeze, where it's just like, it just comes out.
He's very elegant on a bike. I once saw him get on a kid's bike in front of his house, and somehow he made that bike that was completely too small for him. He was elegant, yet even on that.
Yeah.
Okay, so as we're getting close to the end of this interview, you bring to mind something that I'd like to ask. You know that song, Jimmy Buffett's song, A Pirate Looks at 40?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how about a cyclist looks at 70? I mean, now we've got electric bikes. The Segway, I'm an athlete. I'm out a lot. I mean, you get older, you just can't perform like you did before, although your spirit may compel you to do so. So And for many people that ride bikes or are outside hiking or whatever, they do it because they truly love it and want to be out there. But yet age changes things. So how do you see yourself riding into the future?
Well, I am in the future. I'm 65. I'm on Medicare. I'm all good. I'm very conflicted on the electric mountain bike or road bike, which is now also coming too, by the way. There are people that are riding electric road bikes and group rides. Mm-hmm. You know, starting to happen. This is, if you follow the trade magazines, the e-mountain bike thing has been happening in Europe for very many years. And we had an individual we inducted into the Hall of Fame a couple years ago who's a phenomenally strong guy. He's probably, 4 or 5 years older than I am. Raced with Tomasz Frisznet's father. You know, is a fast, fast boy. And He's plenty strong, does big rides. He rides an electric mountain bike in Europe. It's like, but you can do the same, or I can go farther. This will be the unpopular opinion, and it won't hold. Why can't you just be different? In other words, so do I get a ride? Am I doing the Davis 200? I guess I still could do the Davis 200, but I'm not going to be doing the Davis 200 in 8 hours and 59 minutes anymore. Isn't that okay? So the ride that I did that I would do for 3 hours up on Mount Tam, I go on these things. Why can't I ride for 3 hours and then do like 2/3 of the amount I did before?
How about the time when you're in your 90s? How many riders do you have in your 80s and 90s?
Oh, I actually could name some. Not necessarily 90s, but in 80s that are phenomenal. Ron Sweet's like my hero. I've got a cycling hero, Ron Sweet. I think Ron's like 83 years. And I have Chuck, who's a kneeboarder that's still like surfing. Like, so I've got Chuck and Ron are my like two, like, you know, and Chuck's starting to slow down. Like Tim and I are like, Chuck, you can't slow down, dude. We've kind of got you here. So you got to keep going.
You're our horizon.
Because this is kind of where we want to be, where you are. I think that, yes, I think there's a place for it. Part of the problem with e-mountain bikes or e-electric road bikes, if you see a bike rolling through Mill Valley that's going at unnatural speed, what kind of bike is it? It's an electric bike. So why would you be going, if I'm like flying up the Eldridge Grade, why should you be on something that's faster than I am? Mm-hmm. You know, when I'm going good. So why should you be faster than you were? So I'm okay, you know, for getting people out there, but they shouldn't be going unnatural speeds. Mm-hmm. But you know what? This is one of those things. I don't know what, you know, it's the wave happened in Europe. If it's happened there, it's going to happen here. But I think, you know, this goes to a societal thing. So, I mean, why do you have to be, what's the term? 60s the new 40 or 70s the new 50. Who can't you just be you? Can't you just adjust and age gracefully and adjust as you get older? You know, but I'm more like, hey, I'm like 88 and I can't get up the stairs and I'd like to go up the top mountain. But that's not, I don't think that's who you're bringing up. I think you're more bringing up more people because you're seeing electric bikes. I'm seeing people in their 40s on electric mountain bikes.
No, I'm actually speaking to the spirit of the experience to you. I mean, you've got, as tired as you say you are, you have a tremendous amount of vitality. You may be that one that somebody else is using as their horizon of the future. You may be 90 years old and out there on the bike. And there are actual changes that take place in the body. Some things you don't want to let go of because it just means that much to you.
Right.
And it's hard to get off the saddle.
Right. And I'm not getting off the saddle.
You're not getting off the saddle.
Not getting off the surfboard, not getting off the saddle.
Not going to happen.
Not going to happen. So that's okay. You know, I can adjust. I'm pretty tough. Yeah, I've got some stamina.
Okay. I just wanted to be clear about that.
Yes.
Okay. I think we've covered a lot of terrain.
Perfect.
What haven't we talked about that you would like to say?
Let's see. I think we're pretty good. I guess, you know, with Fisher, you know, I don't know how your interview went with him. You know, so that, you know, I would say it's always good to have different people's perceptions. I think it's also good to be listening to the cacophony of different people and their viewpoints. And also that I don't think that an interview with Joe, Mark, you know, myself or Steve is necessarily going to be self-aggrandizing and trying to tell something that wasn't. You know, so that would be my statement.
Well, it takes many eyes to see the world, which is why I'm so glad you sat down with me today to describe what you see in your world and your experiences. And when you collectively put these stories together, in my experience, it's amazing how aligned they are.
Yeah. Oh, no, I think they are in many different ways.
It's amazing, but yet we do like to see different perspectives because that's the truth of life.
Yes.
So with that final thought in mind, we'll conclude this interview.
Perfect.
And I just want to say thank you very much on behalf of the Mill Valley Public Library and the Mill Valley Historical Society for carrying me along this ride you've been on for a good long while. And I'll see you on Mount Tam.
No worries.